I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:21 on Thursday, May 1st, 2025. We're here in room 120. Please mute all cell phones and please excuse my lack of a voice this afternoon. Our members present today are Representatives McCabe, Representative Vance, Representative Moore, Representative Holland, Representative Himshute, Vice Chair Story, and myself, Representative Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary today is Andy Magnuson, and our moderator from the Juno LIO is Zachary Lawhorn. And thank you all for helping us today. We do have four items on today's agenda for House State Affairs. We will start with consideration of the governor's appointee to the Alaska Police Standards Council, Timothy Collins. We will then have consideration of amendments on House Joint Resolution 10 on a constitutional POMV from Representative Schrage. After that, we'll have an introductory hearing on House Bill 24, Aggravating Factors at Sentencing, from Representative Josephson. And public testimony and continued discussion as time allows for House Bill 152, the Education Head Tax Bill, from Representative Galvin. So the first item on today's agenda is consideration of the governor's appointee to the Alaska Police Standards Council, Mr. Timothy Collins. If you'd like to put yourself on the record and introduce yourself for the committee, we will then take questions from the committee.
Thank you, ma'am. My name is Timothy Collins. Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. It is a tremendous honor to be considered for a position within the Alaska Police Standards Council. I'm grateful for your time and consideration. I've proudly served in law enforcement for nearly 13 years, starting my career with the Newcastle County Police Department in Delaware in 2012. Over those years, I've gained invaluable experience working in patrol and as a detective within the property crime squad, eventually transitioning into the Special Victims Unit. In that role, I investigated some of the most sensitive and challenging cases, focusing on crimes against children and sexual offenses. Throughout my career, I've also had the privilege of serving in specialized part-time assignments, including the crisis negotiations team, where I was trained to manage critical incidents, and as an instructor on topics like ethics in policing, sex crimes, and crimes against children. In 2021, I made the decision to lateral to the Alaska State Troopers, a move that allowed me to serve in a place where community and integrity are paramount. I served as a patrol trooper in Soldotna and Demonic, experiencing firsthand the unique challenges and rewards of policing in Alaska's diverse environments. In 2023, I was promoted to sergeant, and I'm currently the post and patrol supervisor for our Kodiak post, where I lead and mentor a dedicated team of troopers. My experience has allowed me to gain insight into the complexities of law enforcement in both urban and rural settings, and I've worked hard to support the principles of accountability, professionalism, and service to the community. As I reflect on my career, I recognize the responsibility that comes with serving in a leadership role like the one before me today. If confirmed, I will work diligently to uphold the highest standards of law enforcement in Alaska, ensuring that our officers are equipped with the training, resources, and support they need to serve our communities effectively. I'm committed to promoting transparency, ethical policing, and accountability to foster trust between law enforcement and the public we serve. Thank you again for considering my nomination, and I look forward to any questions you may have.
Seems like we have a couple questions. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Sergeant Collins. It looks like you have a very important resume for the area that you're supervising. With that in mind of the crisis intervention, the Special Victims Unit, what is it that you hope to bring to the Police Standards Council and see as one of the top needs in the requirements and training?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Representative Vance. I think the biggest thing is, especially with my experience working out in Ammonic, I was out there as a solo trooper on a two-week on, two-week off basis. But I think the biggest need and some of the biggest requirements we need is to kind of boost and expand our sex assault investigation training and crisis intervention training. for both troopers and police officers that are going out to work in some of these rural areas. I think a lot of these troopers are tasked and police officers are tasked with conducting investigations sometimes by themselves that if they were in an urban setting or an urban environment would be these investigations be turned over to a detective bureau or the Alaska Bureau of Investigations that have a little more resources at their fingertips just due to being in like the Anchorage area or the Matsu Valley area. So I think one of the biggest things I would like to see is have a mandatory requirement for any new officers or troopers going out to work in rural Alaska to have a more in-depth sex assault training program.
Follow up. Thank you, Sergeant, for that. That's, I think I am, that's definitely a direction that I think many of us would like to see. And I just want to put a plug in to add the human and sex trafficking training to that, to recognize exploitation when it happens. And I know that that the department has been working on training modules, or at least some e-learning, to improve the access for our officers. But really appreciate that you just even verbalizing that, because that's what we hear in the building a lot. But I also want to thank you for the work that you're doing and recognizing that, because we don't want to send officers unprepared to what they're facing, and also recognize that troopers are essentially have to be a one-man band. So thank you for your service. Thank you for the leadership that you're providing.
Thank you, ma'am.
Great. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair. Thank you, Sergeant, for being here and for being able to talk with you a little bit. And I appreciate also, as the other representative said, the breadth of experience that you have here. In particular, somewhat following up, I'm interested in your view on the VPSO program, our efforts to increase its staffing. And in particular, I'm curious how you view that program and the individuals in it with respect to the Police Standards Council work and the training and work that we do with the rest of the state troopers and police that the council oversees, and how we could strengthen the relationship of the VPSO program and its contribution to public safety and response and coordinating with other officers who may come in to assist them on more complicated situations.
Yeah, thank you, sir, for the question through the chair. I think the VPSO program, it's a great program. Throughout my career in Alaska, I've worked with some great VPSOs, both in my time in Mnemonic and now in Kodiak. Here in Kodiak specifically, we've started and kind of allowed the VPSOs to come and do ride-alongs with us. The troopers here are constantly going out to the village and doing training with them on different topics that they're going to find themselves in or potentially can find themselves in, being that they're by themselves in the village and going to be waiting for us to get there for some of those higher level felony crimes such as homicide, sex assault. So we take a proactive approach here in Kodiak on kind of talking them through and telling them expectations and what they need to do to preserve evidence, to maintain scene security, to provide safety for the victims, and et cetera, before we get there. I think with the Alaska Police Standards Council, I think being able to kind of speak to all the coordinators for the VPSO program and see what each area needs specifically and then try to provide that training, I think would be beneficial to the VPSOs due to them being understaffed and a lot of times working alone with even less resources than a lot of rural troopers have. I mean, these guys and gals go out and conduct law enforcement duties without a firearm, you know, with a taser, a baton, and pepper spray, and are still, you know, being effective and being respected in the villages that they serve. I think it's definitely a tough career, and I think as much as we can provide as a police standards council and as an agency to them, I know it's my opinion that we try to give them the best training and best resources we can in the difficult situations that they often find themselves in.
Good. Thank you for that.
Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Through the chair, Officer Collins, I'm just trying to look up. We've had, I think, three. You're our third candidate for the Police Standards Council, and so thank you for your willingness to serve and for the work that you do. So far, it's been a lot of men, and I can't find the membership of the council. Do you know if the council has any women? And then I guess my other question is, why do you want to serve on this council?
Yes. So actually, our the chairperson of the council, Rebecca Harmon, is from the Bristol Bay region. She serves on one of the civilian roles. And so she's the chairperson for the council. There's also, I believe, Dusty Dumont, who's the one of the corrections positions, and then there's another female who serves as for one of the corrections positions. Why I want to serve, I think there are bringing the experience I have, kind of having that outside knowledge of outside Alaska, I think is valuable to coming up here and kind of sharing what other places are doing, what has worked for other places. I think sometimes, especially just being in Alaska for the 4 years I have been, there definitely is, at times there could be a little bit of a lack of building collaborative relationships. And in working in such a densely populated area in Delaware, I'm used to coordinating with agencies in Maryland, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Virginia, and being able to work together and kind of come to a solution. I think sometimes that's forgotten about up here just because we are kind of isolated. So being able to bring that kind of background to the table and working together with people to bring the best training we can bring up to Alaska for our law enforcement officers, and along with the other aspect of the Standards Council is, holding officers accountable for wrongdoing or coming up with a solution as to, okay, there wasn't any wrongdoing. I think my experience and coming to the table with that, I will be able to sorry, I lost my train of thought there for a second. I have a very strong stance on doing the work that we do correctly and efficiently, and I think when officers or troopers drop that standard, they need to be held accountable, and that's another reason why I want to serve.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up?
Yeah, this is a really quick follow-up. Thank you for that response, and I know that Becky Hammond is from King Salmon, so my other question that you may or may not have the answer to, so I apologize if I'm putting you on the spot, but your time in Emonic has clearly given you some ideas for the needs in rural Alaska. I don't know how much other representation from rural Alaska is on the council, but I hope that you will bring your experiences from the rural parts of our state. I hope that that will inform decisions that you make and perspectives that you hold. So thank you again for being willing to serve.
Thank you, ma'am.
Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair, thank you for your willingness to serve. When I think so much about the Police Standards Council, I think so much about ethics and officers working at the most highest ethical standard possible, and also the importance of building community trust. And you've sort of answered how you would do that in different ways, but I really would like you to share a few thoughts on
the importance of building community trust and how you see that happening through the troopers and police, through the Police Standards Council.
Yeah, thank you, ma'am, for the question. Through the chair, I think, especially as an Alaska State Trooper, we have a very unique job. And that's not just unique to Alaska, but unique to the entire country. So our community policing looks a little different than community policing in, you know, inner city Baltimore, inner city New York City. We're getting on planes and getting troopers out to these villages to attend different events. I know in Ammonic, I made it a point to get out and spend time at different events in the community, whether that be a potluck, a basketball game, and interact with the elders and the children to show them that, you know, when a trooper comes to town, it's not always and only just for us to take somebody away and get immediately back on the plane and fly off. But I think there's a lot of communities in Alaska that rarely see us just because of the remoteness and stuff. And I know here in Kodiak, before I got here as a supervisor, a lot of the troopers weren't getting out to the villages, and I made that a point, and that was part of throughout the promotional process, I kind of made that aware to the agency that that was what my goal was to, and we're getting guys out at least once or twice a week to our villages here. The troopers here are doing at least one or two RONs, which are remain overnights, in the villages, and helping out the VPSOs throughout the community, attending different community events. So people know our faces when we are there, whether that be to arrest somebody or just walking around, and people are comfortable coming up to us. I think being able to promote that and in the agency is going to just strengthen our relationships with the communities. And then with the Standards Council, you know, there's the aspect of training, and I think being able to kind of have the ability to seek out, whether it be just a couple hour training or a self-paced module on community policing, I think something like that would be valuable to get out to officers and troopers, just to reiterate the fact that we should be pillars in the community and be someone that people can come up to for advice or just to talk to. And like I said earlier, we shouldn't only be looked at as law enforcers. And the more that we're getting out and into these communities and being there, people are going to become more comfortable with us.
Thank you.
I think we have probably time for one more question. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Sergeant. So thank you for your service. Looks like you're a pretty fast mover, Sergeant, in 2 years. Does that sound about right? And or did you just go to Kodiak as a regular trooper and then fleet up to Sergeant? Maybe I should.
Thank you, sir.
Answer that real quick, because I have another one.
Okay. Thank you, sir. So I came to the troopers with just under 10 years of law enforcement experience in Delaware. When I was in Delaware, like I stated, I worked patrol. I was in a property crimes unit, then a special victims unit, along with as a certified police instructor there and on the crisis negotiations team as a negotiator. So I came to Alaska with a lot of police experience prior to Alaska law enforcement. So I think some of that may have been taken into consideration throughout the promotional process.
Thanks. I appreciate that. So now to the real question. That was sort of a comment. So Commissioner Cockrell has a real heart for the MMIP program and on the Police Standards Council. I'm wondering if you are planning to sort of echo that and help with the large list of missing that we have going, and how you would bring that kind of idea to the Police Standards Council.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the commissioner pushing that program is very valuable to Alaska and its citizens. Alaska is kind of, if you ever go onto the missing persons page on the DPS website, it's incredible how many missing people we have in Alaska, but specifically the missing and murdered Indigenous people. I think there's been definitely a lack of accountability with some of these cases throughout the years. I think that now we have an abundance of investigators assigned to just missing and murdered Indigenous persons. And I think as the Police Standards Council is concerned with that, I mean, again, the big thing with that is training and just being able to seek out some great training from the lower 48 and trying to bring that up to Alaska to assist these investigators, troopers, and officers in different investigative techniques and cold case investigations. And I think trying to push that and get some of this training that is normally not available in Alaska. And if we can get it up to Alaska, it'll save both the state money from sending people out. So I think that would be my biggest push, would be trying to get some of that training up here to have in-house with to increase those efforts.
Thanks, Sergeant. I appreciate it. And once again, I appreciate your service.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Sergeant Collins, for calling in and for answering all of our questions today. We really appreciate your service. And at this time, we're just going to briefly open public testimony on this appointee for the Police Standards Council. And is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify on this nominee? Seeing none, we're going to close public testimony. And at this time, we're going to take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Seeing no additional discussion, and in accordance with AS39.05.080, the House State Affairs Committee held a hearing on the following appointee and recommends they be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. For the Alaska Police Standards Council, Timothy Collins. A signature on the report does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against confirmation of this individual during future sessions. At ease. House State Affairs Committee is back on the record, and the next item on today's agenda is House Joint Resolution 10, a PUMV constitutional amendment from Representative Schrage. This is our third hearing on the resolution. At our hearing on Thursday, April 24th, I set an amendment deadline of Wednesday, April 30th at 5 p.m., which was yesterday. We do have one amendment, and before getting to amendments, is there any additional discussion on House Joint Resolution 10? I will just note for committee members that we do have CEO Devin Mitchell and CIO Marcus Frampton from the Alaska Permanent Fund in the room with us today. Any additional discussion? Okay, then I guess we will go to amendment number one. I will turn to Representative Vance.
I move amendment number one, A.2.
And I'll object for discussion.
This amendment adds the requirement for payment of a dividend to eligible state residents. This does not include a calculation. This just says that there will be an annual dividend that is required by the Constitution according to state law. That way there is an assurance from what people assume is already in the Constitution. I know that I've had to have a lot of conversations about clarification that the dividend is not in our Constitution, the corporation is. And this would provide that assurance that people will get one that is based upon state law rather than continuing on with what they feel is a breach of public trust. So this is the language from last year's HJR 7, which is an agreement that there had been many conversations around how it should be worded to include a dividend in the Constitution, and some people wanted a formula that they could rely on, and we recognize the need to make adjustments, like for instance the level of the PUMV. So there's a lot of consternation about getting that prescriptive in the Constitution. And so that's why this one merely states that it would be a dividend to eligible Alaskans, and then the rest of it is basing upon the transfer and the typical language that many of us have seen before.
Thank you. I'd like to, before we go to committee discussion, just ask Representative Shragi, as the sponsor of the resolution, to comment on Amendment 1. Thank you for joining us, Representative Shragi.
Thank you for having this before the committee again, Chair Carrick. For the record, Representative Shragi, representing House District 12, to the chair. So I am opposed to Amendment Number 1, I think most principally just because it does put the dividend on autopilot and in the Constitution according to the current statutes. And, I mean, for example, in the fiscal year that we're currently working on, fiscal year 26, that would force, per the Constitution, a $1.5 billion deficit on the state of Alaska, requiring either massive cuts across the board to state government, from public safety and education on down the line, or taxes that I think would be unbearable by the people of Alaska. So I appreciate the desire to constitutionalize the dividend, but I think it is dangerous fiscal policy.
And then I have a queue going. I have Representative Himshute first.
I'll pass it up.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So I'm confused. not a abnormal thing. How would this put a one point? I mean, this just says a dividend, right? It doesn't necessarily say, and sorry, through the chair, this doesn't put any formula in there. We just have to determine the formula, right? So maybe this year, because there is a formula, but if we determine the formula in statute before the end of the session, then it could be zero, right? I mean, that's what we discussed in the fiscal policy working group. You were there. And that was one of the things that we agreed on, was constitutionalizing APFD. It could be zero, or it could be whatever the formula says. We made a mistake, I think, when we did away with the income tax instead of zeroing it out, right? Mm-hmm. So we would put the formula in statute, as you and I discussed several 80 hours worth of discussion, and this would just constitutionalize APFD. So I'm unclear. Are you just talking about this year alone?
Thank you for the question, Representative McCabe, through the chair to Representative McCabe. So I think the concern is not that we couldn't change the statute. The concern is that it puts that statute on autopilot unless there is a change. And that change would require not only a consensus on what that change should be, and absent some consensus, again, that statutory formula would automatically carry forward without appropriation. The only appropriation that I'm aware of that would be carried out and enacted in that way. Additionally, as we're all very aware, it's not just the consensus of our body and the other body, but also the consensus of the administration, and this or any future administration could veto that legislation, again, putting whatever is in statute on autopilot at a very high vote threshold to adjust. And I think, again, that is a dangerous thing to do, putting that sort of policy in the Constitution.
Follow up.
Thanks.
So what you're asking Alaskans to vote on in this constitutional change is to constitutionalize a 25, am I mistaken, a 2575 PFD and in, I'm sorry, that's a different one. So you are talking about combining the two funds in this one and a 5% UMB.
That is correct.
And yet you don't want to give them the opportunity to just say, we will pay APFD. It might be a dollar, but we will pay APFD based on a formula that we determine.
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, again, putting an appropriation on autopilot in the Constitution is a very dangerous fiscal policy to pursue.
Okay. Thanks.
I put myself in the queue as well. We have a couple other folks as well. I guess I would look to the sponsor's comment on this comment, but I see a more fundamental problem than just potential cost from the amendment, and that's that constitutionalizing the sort of fiscal policy that's in the underlying resolution helps to provide for constitutionally mandated services. And what Amendment Number 1 would do is it would constitutionalize the dividend as one of those essential services, essentially, that we must provide it. So I guess my question to the sponsor is, would this amendment, in your opinion, put the dividend on the same equal playing field as, say, public safety or education, which are described in the Constitution?
To the chair, Representative Shragi, for the record, I actually would go further and say that this amendment would put the dividend above all other services that the state provides. No other service points specifically to a statute to determine the level of appropriation for those services. So while we do have a constitutional obligation for things such as education, it does not say that we shall provide for education without appropriation by law. This would put the dividend above all else and force essentially for the state to pay out a dividend and in a very dire fiscal environment not be able to provide for any other state services.
As a follow-up question, there are other countries with sovereign wealth funds. Do any of them have a charter or constitutional requirement to pay to their residents? In other words, is there any sort of precedence in other sovereign wealth fund models for something like what's proposed in this amendment?
To the chair, Representative Shragi, for the record, not that I'm aware of, but I do not have comprehensive research on that topic.
Okay, I'll leave it there. Representative Holland.
Sure, thank you. Through the chair, I think to the maker of the amendment, I just want to clarify what I think is happening here, which is that the original bill seeks to combine the earnings reserve account and the main corpus of the account into one account. And if I understand the amendment that's been made, it fundamentally says, no, we're not going to do that, that we're going to leave a earnings reserve account and keep it separate, which basically, I think, if I'm interpreting this right, is basically saying, no, we're not going to do what the bill is proposing. Am I understanding that fundamental aspect of what happens with the language that's on page 2, starting at line 24, that essentially this amendment proposes to keep the earnings reserve account and not combine it? Am I understanding that right?
Madam Chairman, do you want me to respond now?
Yeah, Representative Fan. Sorry, I was looking. As long as I don't have to respond.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Holland, I had this same question when we drafted the amendment, and it was explained to me that this would keep the earnings reserve account within the corpus of the fund. So it's not because I didn't want to completely undo the original proposal, but include the annual dividend in there. So it was explained to me that this would be a fund within the fund.
Can I follow up?
Follow up.
I wonder if the sponsor or perhaps representative from the fund could clarify if that's how they view this is going to work, because I'm reading it as it essentially keeps it separate, but maybe I'm just missing a point. Maybe you could clarify that just so I understand what this amendment would do.
To the chair, it may be best to go to Ledge Legal on this one, but my understanding is it does keep the two-account structure, but makes it such that the second account is constitutionally protected to some degree. But it does retain a two-account structure.
So, Representative Holland, we don't have Ledge Legal online. We could take an Addies and get them online if you'd like.
Thank you, Chair. I think given the rest of the concerns, I think I will probably not support the amendment. So I don't think having more clarification will probably change that. I appreciate the discussion we've had. It creates enough uncertainty that I think I'm not comfortable with this amendment moving forward at this point in time.
Okay. Is there additional discussion on the amendment? All right. So I do maintain my objection. I really do appreciate the maker of the amendment's intent here and the comments about this being part of the fiscal policy working group. But at this time, I do oppose amendment number 1. And Seeing no further discussion, I'll have the clerk please call the roll.
Representative Himshute.
No.
Representative Story.
No.
Representative Moore.
Yes.
Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Representative Holland.
No.
Representative Vance.
Yes.
Chair Carrick.
No.
3A, 4A.
So the vote of 3A's and 4A's, amendment number 1, also known as A.2, does not pass the committee. And that brings the underlying legislation, H.J.R. 10, back before us. And is there any additional discussion at this time on H.J.R. 10? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to bring forward the amendment. There are a lot of concerns by Alaskans about the underlying bill of the danger of moving to a full endowment model. And specifically, making that constitutional change without constitutionalizing a dividend. The very first finance chair who appropriated a dividend said that it should be the first draw to Alaskans. I know that in the past 8 years, we faced a lot of fiscal uncertainty, and our revenues have completely flipped upside down. And I'm glad that we've had our rainy day funds and our CBR. However, it has really, really created a poor fiscal oversight. And I think that we've, as the legislature, have looked to the savings and not really dug in to find the efficiencies in government that we need to. And it's created a lot of distrust with Alaskans. And so now they are hopeless that they will even have a dividend that is a share of their resource wealth at all. And they've lost trust in the legislature because of that. Everyone understands that we have hard decisions with the budget to make. However, they want to make sure that they still have a piece of their resource wealth. And I think passing this amendment without the inclusion of a dividend is something that is going to lack the votes to reach the threshold needed, because Alaskans have broken trust in what we plan to do with the permanent fund itself. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, this was part of the fiscal policy working group. We had many discussions over this. We also had many discussions, and Representative Shragi is now officially excommunicated from the Fiscal Policy Working Group. Where'd he go? So we had many discussions about this particular thing, and one of the things that we said is we wanted it all to march together forward. After a while, we recognized that was going to be impossible because of the single subject rule and various other things, but the previous amendment would have been an opportunity to put another piece into what we had discussed and have at least two pieces march together. Without the rest of it, however, I'm going to be in the same boat. Without a spending cap, without all the other things that we talked about on the Fiscal Policy Working Group, just having this resolution in there is a recipe for disaster, in my opinion. And frankly, Representative Vance touched on it. The wealth underneath our feet belongs to Alaskans. It doesn't belong to you and I, except for a small piece of it, but it belongs to Alaskans, and it's up to them to decide how to do it. And they are clearly communicating to me, at least the people in my district, that they are very angry at us for taking the money and using it the way we feel it should be spent instead of allowing them to use it the way they feel it should be spent. So I'm hesitant to mess with this in any manner. In fact, I think if it gets put in front of the voters, it will certainly be voted down, but it will certainly be voted down from my perspective, but you all are probably going to pass it, so we might as well go to a vote.
Any additional discussion? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion. Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that HJR 10, also known as 34-LS0648/A, be moved from the House State Affairs Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Object.
Objections noted. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Holland.
Yes.
Representative Himshute.
Yes.
Representative Moore.
No.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative McCabe.
Absolutely no.
Representative Vance.
No.
Chair Carrick.
Yes.
Four yea, three nay.
On a vote of four yeas and three nays, HJR 10 has been reported from the House State Affairs Committee. We will take a brief recess to sign the paperwork. House State Affairs Committee is back on the record. In just a moment, I'm going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Story so that I can go to a bill hearing in another committee. But next on our agenda is House Bill 24, Aggravating Factors at Sentencing, by Representative Josephson. We will start with a brief introduction, Representative Josephson, of the bill, and we do have several invited testifiers who have joined us as well. So at this time, thank you to Representative Josephson and staff for being available to present your legislation today, and I will turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Story to continue the discussion.
Thank you, Chair Carrick, and I am going to turn it right over to Representative Josephson to please state your name for the record, proceed with your introduction and your presentation, or go to your, I believe we discussed about the importance of going to your invited testifiers before the presentation today, as there was a time limit for them. So,
sure. Josephson, let's do it. Can we do an audio check first? Can you hear me?
I can hear you very well. Thank you for asking.
Beautiful. Thank you. I want to thank Chair Carrick, and now we have Chair Story. I'm going to be quite brief and tell you why this bill is before us and why I feel so strongly about it. I'm Andy Josephson, House District 13 at South Midtown in Anchorage. I find myself in my hometown just today. I'll be returning to the Capitol tomorrow morning. Madam Chair, before you is a House bill that is a crime bill, technically. It adds four words to part of the sentencing code, and the sentencing code is in 1255, and those four words would be sexual orientation and gender identity. And essentially, the 1255 is a sentencing code that focuses on what are called aggravators and mitigators. The Alaska law has 37 types of aggravators. And if someone is a victim of assault or worse, God forbid, and they are a person who was attacked because of race, sex, color, creed, physical or mental disability, ancestry or national origin, the defendant, upon a showing of evidence before a trial jury, could have their sentence increased. Could have. The judge could have the discretion to say, no, I'm not going to do it. What brings this case, or this rather this bill before us, was an unfortunate series of events that started in November 2019, extended into, I think, December 2019, I filed this bill in February 2020. I refiled it the last two legislatures. And what happened, and you'll hear the victim at the time testify, and she's very brave to have done this now a third time, that is to testify a third time. But she was feloniously assaulted, and I think very clearly targeted because of her sexual orientation. This became known to the public as she was working on a pride parade preparation in the Soldotna Kenai area. And I was on vacation in December 2019. When I read about this, I found it horrific. And so I want to join 31 other states and add a penalty when when a person is attacked because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. The bill came in 2020 as House Bill 198. It was moved out of state affairs. The onset of COVID undermined the bill's efforts. It was passed out of state affairs in 2020. It was passed out of judiciary in 2022, but did not get through to the House. The bill was supported in the 2020 to 2022 timeframe by the City of Soldotna City Council, the Kenai City Council, and by the Borough Assembly. The Kenai City Council by a vote of 5-1. Interestingly, then Councilman, I think, of the City of Soldotna, Ruffridge, supported that amendment. And just a couple of more comments. Under F2 of the bill, 1255, we're not changing F2, but 1255, 155, the factors would be presented to a trial jury, the same jury that had just found the defendant guilty, presumably, and they must prove, the prosecutor would have to prove by beyond a reasonable doubt, that the intent of the assailant was to target somebody because of their status in a class. And that's the bill, ladies and gentlemen. I could talk for a very long time about it, but fundamentally, often crime happens, if it's domestic violence, that's clearly not random because it's relational. But sometimes crimes, including assaults, happened completely randomly. This is the opposite of that. This is where a person is targeted because of an inherent part of their personhood. And so what this bill does is it says, for retributive, deterrent, or symbolic reasons, we as a matter of public policy are saying that if you target someone who's vulnerable in that way, that could aggravate a sentence. I could say a lot more, but I'll stop there. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Do we have any questions for Representative Josephson? Seeing none, if it's all right with you, Representative Josephson, we could go on to your invited testifiers.
I would like that.
Okay. So, thank you. I will ask our invited testifiers I guess they're online, not in the room. So I will ask our invited testifiers to keep their comments to 3 minutes. First up, we have Tammy Willis. Please state your name, affiliation, and where you are calling in from for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Tammy Willis. I would prefer not to give my location of where I live because the assailant still has not been located. In October of 2019, I received a note on my truck window that basically identified that I needed to go somewhere else and stop trying to influence the community of children and so forth to be LGBTQ. In November, somebody threw a rock through my truck window while I was driving, and on that rock was the word dyke. And then in December of 2019, as I was leaving my home during a power outage, I encountered an assailant who left me with quite a number of stitches and in my left arm, including a very large gash and 3 smaller gashes, as well as a gash in my chest from a knife. The police recovered the knife, or the state troopers recovered the knife, but there was never really any investigation to try to figure out what had occurred, how it occurred, and who was involved and in responsible for it. I have since lived with a great deal of fear in my life. I had to leave the Kenai Peninsula and move to Anchorage, and I now venture out of Alaska and am traveling around the country just exploring things. While I still call Alaska my home, and that's still where my heart is, it is not a safe place for me. I still receive death threats on a regular basis. And I have had to defend myself against accusations that the assault itself was not true or real, and when I bear the scars for it. essentially, what I'm doing is I really want to support Mr. Josephson's efforts on this because I think it is important. The LGBTQ community, meaning, you know, sexual orientation and gender identity, is still not a protected class in every state. And in many of those states, we are the highest rate of violence towards us that goes unresolved and unreported because we do not feel that we have the support or the protection of law enforcement and the judiciary. So having this would mean a lot because it gives us that feeling that we do matter, that we do count, and that violence against us is not going to be tolerated. And the fact that this is still a discussion in Alaska and still a needed amendment or a bill tells me that in Alaska there are still a lot of issues and a lot of people out there who do not feel safe or secure in who they are or being who they are or their authentic self. So unless you have any other questions, I just really would like to see you encourage you guys to pass this, let it get to the floor where you can have a full discussion on it, and people can understand that, you know, as human beings, we're all entitled to respect, kindness, dignity, and safety.
Thank you for your testimony today, Ms. Willis, and I appreciate you sharing your story. Next, we will go to Karen Leffler. Please state your name, affiliation, where you're calling in from, and proceed with your testimony.
Hello. My name is Karen Leffler. I'm calling in from Anchorage, and I'm the former U.S. attorney for Alaska and also spent 30 years in prosecution for Alaska. I don't have much to add to what the previous person testified. I just want to make two points in terms of the dangerousness and the seriousness of these crimes. First, on behalf of the dangerousness of the perpetrator, they're committing an act not because of a personal or a situational circumstance. This is somebody that has hate in them and decides to target vulnerable people, and that's a very dangerous proposition. The second thing, and in some ways more importantly, is if you look at the side of the victim and our desire as a society to protect people, I think myself and probably many of you, when you see a shooting in the paper and you say, oh, was it 3 a.m. in the morning and it was, you know, done so-and-so, oh, okay, that's not a place I would be. Well, these victims are victimized for nothing that their status, nothing that they can do about, no way to protect themselves, this woman. She was victimized solely because of who she is. And that's a really unsafe circumstance, and there is an obligation to say, I'm sorry, I'm in my house. Anyway, and so I think that this is important in order to send a message that we need to protect all of our citizens. And that's really all I have to say. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions for the testifiers? I do not see any questions for the testifiers, and thank you both very much for your testimony today. So I am going to bring it back to Representative Josephson to see if he has any other remarks, and then we could go to the presentation from Mr. Alper, if that is your preference, Rep. Josephson.
Yes, that is my preference. I would note that the bill in 2020, you know, I'm thinking of Gary Knopp now, who was a colleague of ours and passed away in a tragic airplane crash. But after the events that Ms. Willis has described, 200 people came to the Soldotna Town Hall or Kenai Town Hall, including Senator Michiki and Representative Knopp and others. And we had seven co-sponsors, and I feel very passionate about this bill. But yes, I'm ready for the PowerPoint at this time.
Yes, thank you for those remarks, Rep. Josephson. I remember very much the outrage from that community. Thank you.
How do I get connected?
And I also wanted to show that Rep. Galvin has joined us in the room. Thank you.
Sorry, it's gonna get out. What's that?
Brief at ease. So please proceed, introduce yourself, put your name on the record, and welcome, Mr. Alper.
Thank you, Vice Chair Story. For the record, my name is Ken Alper, staff to Representative Josephson, and I promise I'll be brief. Representative Josephson covered what the bill does substantively, and the invited testifiers really spoke to the need for it. So what you have before you is a bill that amends the, like Representative Josephson said, the portion of law that discusses sentencing, things that a sentencing court should consider after there is a conviction. And AS 1255-155C is really a laundry list. There's 37 items in there that you can – it makes interesting reading. You could see how past legislators, in responding to things that might have happened, have built onto this, that things like if the offender showed deliberate cruelty, if there are multiple victims, if there are three or more prior convictions, if the victim is an officer of the court, if the offender incapacitated the victim with alcohol before the assault, these are all the sorts of things that can be considered by a court. And within those, among 1 through 37, sub 22 is the so-called hate crime statute. Representative Josephson read the current list. The things you would expect to see: race, sex, color, creed, disability, national origin, that sort of thing. What this bill does is adds to that list the word sexual orientation or gender identity, so that people who are targeted, like Ms. Willis was, for their gender identity or for their sexual preference. You, like she said, the rock through her windshield with the word dyke on it was horrifying. So that's what the bill is intending to do. Unfortunately, in her case, apparently the offender has not been caught. But were he to be caught and were he to be convicted, that offender would be subject to an increased sentence because of a hate crime statute. So the point here is that this does not affect the trial itself. It doesn't affect the crime that someone might be charged with or the way that the trial might be brought. It would only affect the process after a conviction and in the sentencing phase. And because of that, this isn't really a hate crime bill. It's a sentencing bill. Only after someone is convicted and the sentence takes place, there's many factors the court considers that can either reduce or increase the sentence, and this adds to the list of – and I see an error in my own slide. There are 37 aggravating factors, not 34, and this adds one. There are a majority of states that already include a sexual orientation and gender identity. Some of them include – just sexual orientation, gender identity is a few fewer than the ones that are – than the states that are protecting sexual orientation as well. So I guess there's a philosophical question. Why do this? Why should there be aggravating factors for hate crimes? And the big picture answer, Madam Chair, is because suddenly it's not just about the victim, but who the victim represents as part of their entire community. And that's in some ways a larger assault on the general public, on the fabric of society itself. Their entire community is threatened when an individual is attacked. And that in turn could lead to retribution, escalation, larger social problems that would occur over time when there's a hate crime. It's important to know the motives and the details around a crime for good and for ill. Sometimes there's an excuse or a reason that could make the crime less than it might otherwise appear. And in this case, there's reasons why the crime is larger than maybe a simple assault on a person just because you were trying to steal their money or something like that. So the aggravators are relevant when there's been a conviction and the crime is broadly considered hateful and or deviant, and that's those are the sort of instructions that a jury would be given. And like I said, to conclude, assault motivated with hate towards a group is a larger repercussion than just an assault on an individual. Statistically, interesting, hate crimes are increasing somewhat over time. These are national statistics, anti-gender hate crimes. This is from the FBI and the Justice Department's websites. You're seeing an upward trend in anti-gender identity hate crimes. I imagine that's going to continue in the current climate. And anti-sexual orientation hate crimes as well have increased over the last 9-10 years, as you could see on this slide. These are the states that currently have hate crime laws that include sexual orientation in the lighter blue and both sexual orientation and gender identity as is proposed in House Bill 24 in the darker blue. So we're talking about two-thirds of the country by number of states, much larger than that from the looks of the map by population, are offering this protection right now. And Alaska, I don't like it when they put Alaska off the coast of Mexico, but a lot of maps do that. And here we are gray and not because we are not currently protected. We're just sort of middle of the pack as far as hate crimes. These are national statistics. You could see us down there as number 23. Hate crimes per 100,000 population. Obviously, we have a smaller population, but just put that up there to show. We are by no means extreme, by no means on either direction. We're sort of, like I said, middle of the pack in the number of hate crimes per capita we get here. In Alaska, these are just some quotes from the Human Rights Commission talking about increases in LGBT attacks. Members could read them themselves. But hate crimes based on sexual orientation are about one-sixth of all hate crimes, the third largest category after race and religion. Interesting thing to know. Multiple states are looking to add or expand upon these rules. These are just a few recent bills. I imagine if I dug a little deeper, I could find some more. But this is a national trend. Representative Josephson is reacting to a local issue, but it's very much part of a national desire to show protection and concern for these kinds of offenses. And these are some stories about the events in Kenai that followed the assault. That first quote, I believe, comes from Miss Willis. I don't want it to be about me. Her interest was in protecting the larger community. And these were all quotes from the Alaska media. And that's really all we have. I'm happy to take more questions. Representative Josephson, I believe, is still online. He could probably answer them better than me. But I'm happy to sit here on his behalf.
Thank you for that presentation, Mr. Alper. Do I have any questions? Rep. Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, just two things I was wanting to learn more about, and I appreciate this bill coming forward and the attention to it. Honestly, I assumed that these mitigating factors were already not only unacceptable but against the law. So to learn that this is an area we need to strengthen in our own codes, I do appreciate it very much. I am curious in terms of the data of the growth in this. It's surprising and concerning to see this going up as we see, and I'm sorry I don't have the slide number, but it's the bar charts that had that. And I'm just curious, do we know to what degree this is changing because we're doing a better job of recognizing this type of aggravated hate crime and collecting the data in order to see the numbers versus how much of this is going up because we indeed have a problem of hate crimes becoming more prevalent? I'm just curious, not trying to excuse it. I'm always a little bit of a data wonk. So when I see this going up, do we know anything more about the data and the real growth versus the classification that allows us to see the numbers and potentially how much more we're missing?
Madam Chair, I'll start because I'm sitting here, but I think Representative Josephson will give a better answer. The FBI statistics that a lot of this is drawn from are repeating publications through the chair to Representative Holland. It looks like their data is solid. My instinct is this is the sort of thing that we got better at collecting 10 or 20 years ago. You know, so maybe not within the period reflected in this graph, but we probably do have some consistency in data going back long enough for this to be material. But I think Representative Josephson might have a little more insight.
Representative Josephson, would you like to comment?
Well, yeah, I think, thank you, through the chair, Representative Holland, Andy Josephson. One of the things I think Representative Holland asked, I think, at the beginning was, do we see any improvement based on the deterrent effect of the public knowing these laws exist? I don't know that we have that sort of answer. But you know, one thing I feel about this is, fortunately, we rarely need this sort of aggravator. But when you need it, as I say, you need it. And If, for example, and I'll note that the main Supreme Court decision, which I reread, is called Wisconsin versus Mitchell, and in that decision, a white person was targeted for attack, and the Supreme Court said that these are not an infringement of free speech and are constitutional. But more specifically to Representative Holland's questions, are we? I think broadly speaking, our country, you see this in situation comedies, for example, is more tolerant of the LGBT community, and that's a good thing. So the trend lines are certainly good, but we have work to do, and I just think that this is part of that work.
Thank you. Follow up, please.
Follow up.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for that information. And again, I'm just learning more about some of the details, and I appreciate what you're bringing forward here. Second question I have is that, as I understand this bill, we're clarifying or adding this as an aggravating factor. I'm just curious, is there other existing statutes that make hate crimes a crime that stand completely independent of this aggravating factor that we're adding into this one statute? I'm just curious if it was missing here, is it missing someplace else?
Through the chair, Representative Holland, I can definitely answer this question. Some states have specific, and I think the feds have specific hate crimes. Some states don't, and we don't. So you could scour the blue books to your right there, and you wouldn't see anything like this. The only place you can find this family of penalties is in 1255C22, which is what we're trying to modify, right, by adding these four words. The way this works is if there's a presumptive sentence based on the nature of the crime or the person was previously a felon, then and a finding that beyond a reasonable doubt the aggravator applies, then a court could add to that presumptive sentence. They wouldn't have to. And in fact, oddly, they could find the aggravator and not add any extra penalty. And you might say, what's that about? And I'm not sure I can answer. But that's a true thing.
A short follow-up, I hope, please.
Follow-up.
Thank you. So if I understand what you just explained to me, if we have a hate crime specifically related to sexual orientation or gender identity that is not related to something else as an aggravating factor, just it's a something standalone as opposed to being added on, it sounds like you're saying we don't currently have a statute that makes that a crime in and of itself by itself. Did I understand that
correctly?
Through
the chair, 100% accurate. 100% accurate.
Wow. Okay. Thank you.
Rep. Henshute.
Thank you, Representative Josephson, for this legislation. I guess I just have a comment, which is I wish this wasn't needed. Mm-hmm. I think Alaska should be a place where you can be whoever you want to be and live without fear. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Yes, and I have a comment that I wish we'd had this presentation before we asked questions of our candidate for the Police Standards Council, because we could have asked what he has seen on the ground and what his thoughts are about training, education, statute laws needed. So thank you for your diligence, actually, to bring legislation forward to make sure that no one is discriminated or harmed because of who they are.
Thank you.
Yes. So, seeing no other questions today for the bill sponsor, we will set this bill aside and proceed to our next bill.
We take a brief at ease.
And we are back on the record, and we are going to go to our next bill that we have today, and that is House Bill 152, Education Head Tax. This is a bill that we have had before us this past week, And we do have public testimony on our agenda today for this bill. Before getting to public testimony, are there any additional comments or committee discussion on the bill 152, education head tax? I guess I would like to add that I've received some comments on this bill from some of my constituents, and one of them is, and I believe, and you were copied on the bill, or else I was copied on some of these amendments or these questions, and they were concerned about the $150 tax, the education tax. And first of all, I wanted to say, as I have visited with people and they have our revenue picture, the number one comment I have had from people is I paid an in, and this was people who lived here for quite a long time, is that they did pay an education tax at one point, and they really felt that that was a good thing, that we supported education and did that through some sort of revenue generator. And I know it was a very minimal amount at that time, and but still it was an important symbol that you've talked about in your bill here, Rep. Galvin, is we're all contributing to the services we use. And I know my question goes, it's a $150 one-time tax. There's two parts of it, but the $150 one-time tax that comes out a certain part of the year would come out of everyone's paycheck. And the concern that came in the mail was the person who's making $50,000 a year would be $150, but if you're making $150 or $75, you also have the $150 charge, and it's much more a bigger percentage of an income if you're making $50,000 versus if you're making $150. And did you have any comments that you would like to make on that concern?
For the record, this is Representative Galvin, and thank you very much for the question and for the really the conversation around the education tax. So the question that I think I heard is about a constituent of yours who has reached out regarding concerns about the head tax being too much for the lower income Alaskan. And I appreciate that very much. My staff will give you some data around what that would mean if we were to change it or eliminate it for certain income brackets. I put this bill forward as a starting place for us to discuss this, I think, important topic around a broad base revenue measure. We know that Alaska has no broad base revenue measure, and so I'm open to any sort of changes, amendments that we think, that you think, more importantly, are going to get us across the threshold of helping us find a space to get enough votes to pass. I will tell you that I have heard from some who felt like every Alaskan, regardless, needs to feel this. And so I can understand that for some, for who make $150,000, $150 doesn't, they're not going to feel it nearly as much as a family who makes $38,000. It's going to be more arduous for them. And I do appreciate that. So like I said, I'm very comfortable with an amendment. Should we decide to change either, there's two things we can change here. We can change we can make a floor for where we take in the head tax differently. So the floor could be, instead of it being all Alaskans, we could say only Alaskans making $75,000 or more, for example. Or we could change the amount from $150 to less. This could become quite complicated if we choose to. All right. It just like our the federal taxes are very complicated. I tried to simplify it with the 150-150. To me, that felt like an easy thing to explain to people. We have a head tax of 150. Everyone pays in. And then we have only the dollars that you make above above 150,000 get taxed at a flat rate. So that was my, the reason I put it in is I thought this is really simple for people to understand. And I'm going to ask my staff, David Jang, to explain the differences should we make those changes. Just a few of the tweaks that we could make.
For the record, this is David Jang, staff to Representative Galvin. I appreciate the question. It's definitely a very salient question. And as we had mentioned in our previous presentation, there are levers that we can adjust to this tax. And definitely having this discussion on, you know, making these adjustments is something that we very much look forward to. So I just put some of these numbers into a model, so adjusting like the head tax in particular and trying to see what these revenue figures are. And I just wanted to say these for the record, what these impacts would be. So the default situation, which is the $150 head tax and the $150,000 standard deduction, the head tax revenue would, according to this model, would be between 62 to 68 million. And the total revenue would be $326 million to $359 million. So this kind of aligns with the fiscal note, which says in the ballpark of $300 to $350 million in revenue. And as you can see, the 4% flat tax is the bulk of this revenue. Now, say if we were to, say, exempt individuals who make $50,000 or less from the $150 head tax, that would just reduce the head tax revenue to $33.6 million to $37 million. But the total revenue in itself would stay at $298 million to $328 million. So as you can see, the bulk of the revenue is from that 4% flat tax. And the $150 head tax is just, that's something that we can adjust through discussion and amendment. And I'll pass it back to the representative.
Thank you. For the record, this is Representative Elise Galvin. And I think in hearing that, you might appreciate that the concept of all in, the amount doesn't really change too much of our overall revenue if we did tweak that. In fact, I did hear from one of your very wise committee members, he liked the idea of a number 49, or the 49th state. And that number also brings in enough revenue to cover the whole of bringing in. We, as you know, we have to stand up a whole new division. And this actually gives us enough money to stand that division up. And then the 4% above that gives us enough, for example, to cover a $1,000 BSA if that's what the state chose, which we didn't choose, but if that were the case. So we were just trying to put this out on the table for you all to have an appreciation for opportunities. And Chair Story, the other thing I would mention is even if we eliminated the head tax for the lower wage makers, that's a possibility. Keep in the 4%. That's a possibility. We can change a lot of different things around. Another suggestion was to phase in so that maybe we start with just the head tax 1 year and the next year we bring in the high wage earner. There's so many options here, and I think what's important is that we think about what our overall revenue need is. And in combination of where we might get revenue in other places and our overall spend, obviously, all of this is part of our important decision-making. And I appreciate that we are listening to constituents as we do this.
Thank you for those comments. I'll take a comment from Rep. Himeshut, and then I would like to go to public testimony and hear what the public has to say. So,
okay,
Rep.
Himeshut. I just have a quick question for the bill sponsor. I don't remember when the head tax was discontinued. It was way back there, but it was something like $20 on January 1st or something like that. If you inflation adjusted that, what would that amount be? So what was the original amount, and have you had the opportunity to calculate inflation in the intervening years and come up with what that would be today if we had not gotten rid of it?
That is something I don't have off the top of my head, but we can get that to you.
For the record, this is Elise Galvin, and I will say that I really appreciate that question, because that's been asked a lot about from a lot of departments. But as they've asked, come forward and ask for more funds for their department, they will have inflation adjusted various costs. So I think that's an important question that we can look into. Yeah, for sure. We'll get back to you soon.
And I forgot to say through the chair, but inflation is the thief in the night.
Thank you for that. And we are going to go to public testimony. So I'm going to open public testimony for House Bill 152. I am going to first go onto the phone to take testimony that's online. First up, we have Carl Berger. If you could please unmute yourself, state your name and any affiliation for the record. Proceed with your testimony, and we have about two. We have 2 minutes per testifier. Please welcome, and please proceed.
Thank you. My name is Carl Berger, and I'm a 60-year resident of Alaska. Came here as a young man. Spent my life working in many areas around the state. Much of my time is in rural Alaska, and I've seen many changes over the years. Just for information, the head tax in the old days was only $10 a year. Yes, that's a very small amount. Of course, it has less value now than it did then. But we all put in something. And for people who are just starting off like I was happy to put that in. And actually, after hearing testimony by people in Anchorage about a month ago, when there were quite a number of legislators in Anchorage for the weekend out at the UAA, I was happy to hear some people speak up and say, we don't mind paying something to help out a basic need in our state, and that is to educate our young people to their best abilities, which I feel is very important. But I have a couple of suggestions for all the legislators that you should consider before you put a lot of energy into how much will each pay. I'm happy to pay something. I'm retired. I spent my life up here. But at the same time, we have a couple of situations I think that should be addressed. We have an oil company who's been doing business in Alaska for years and years, and every year they faithfully pay their taxes for the privilege of doing business here. We have another oil company who took over from BP when they left, and they have been doing business for 5 years in Alaska, and yet they pay nothing. And they are very vocal about how that's reasonable and that should stay the same. Well, I don't agree. I don't think it should stay the same. And the other organization in state government is the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. I think it's time for them to reduce the amount of cash that they have on reserve and put up some money for the educational needs of our young people in this state. So I would suggest somebody talk to Randy Raro about that, and also to Jeff Hildebrand from Hillcore, and just tell them it's time for us to collect something for your efforts here in Alaska. And those are my comments. But again, I'm happy to pay something. But I think other big players should pay something too. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much for your testimony today. And I am going to be given 3 minutes since I forgot to set the timer for when we first started. So I think it's only right everyone has 3 minutes. So I'm going to go next to Evelyn Trifon from New Haven. If you could please introduce yourself for the record, any affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Story and members of the committee. Thank you so much for taking my public testimony today on House Bill 152, Public Education Tax. My name is Evelyn Trifon, and I live in New Haven, Alaska, and I'm calling in today on behalf of myself and my family. I was very disappointed in the veto of the House Bill 69 was brought in the return last week, and during the discussion it was stated that the override could not be supported due to the state's significant budget deficit. I agree that our fiscal situation is serious, and this is why I'm in full support of House Bill 152 as a responsible way to create a dedicated funding stream for public education. We can no longer depend solely on oil tax revenue to meet the growing needs of our state. Shrinking our savings is not a sustainable and prudent path forward. Since 2016, my community has felt the deep impact of the state budget cuts. We've lost our trooper post here in Iliamna. Our school year has been reduced by 20 days. Our kids currently only go to school 150 days for our homeschool year. We've lost our school counselor. Volleyball and basketball jamborees have been cut. We have a long list of deferred maintenance needs at our schools. All of our library staff and funding for e-books have been eliminated. Our PFDs have been capped. Our school playground is well over past in need of replacement, but there's no money to replace it. And now we face the end, possible end of low-income heating assistance and threats to Medicaid and SNAP, which are critical programs rural Alaskans rely on. Thank you again very much for taking the testimony today, and I urge you to support House Bill 152 as a prudent and logical way for funding our schools. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we will go to Mike Coons. If you could please unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, any affiliation, and please proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you for the 3 minutes. My name is Mike Coons from Wasilla, and speaking for myself, I strongly oppose HB 152. This bill will take money from my wallet on top of the 60% that I pay in property taxes to my school district. By the way, the MASU is the leader in education as to merit-based student outcomes and less cost, and are more going to classrooms and teachers versus the worst ASD, whom will be losing $17 million because they choose to push DEI, CRT, LGBTQ. Since this $150 per person is not by district, then that money would go to the likes of the last of Anchorage School District. To those that want this, why haven't they been doing so through their PFD? People can write a check to the state of Alaska and specify what they want that money to go to, yet nobody does. I'm so tired of people wanting other people's money. Why should S-Corps pay for education, especially education of future employees that cannot read, write, and do simple math? Future employees who have been taught DEI and LGBTQ, which is victimization, CRT, which is racism, and are not conducive to a free society. Individuals that have been brought into the above are detrimental to the goals and missions of any successful corporations, and I would hope not hired. This bill is being pushed because the BSA is never going to get to the level that the makers really want. Gavin just said it. I saw a chart the other day that shows spending has skyrocketed from the 1970s, and the outcomes of education have either been flat or in dramatic decline. I went to school from 1958 to 1971, and was a C student. Yet I had the knowledge to do my job in the Air Force and then to excel with a 3.85 GPA in college as a paramedic. Now we have Harvard having to have remedial math for their new students. This is ridiculous. Not no, but heck no on HD 152.
Thank you for your testimony. We will now go to Gail Coons. Please unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record and any affiliation, and begin your testimony.
My name is Gail Coons from Ocbella, and I'm speaking for myself. I oppose HB 152. For the majority of my life as a single and childless citizen, I've paid my share to education, and I've been very happy to do so up until the past few years. Please tell me why I want to continue throwing good money at education with a sad return on my investment. The whining and sniveling from the NEA and teachers who make $60,000 to $84,000 plus a year for a part-time job is beyond maddening. This legislature has raped and pillaged the PFD to the point of little return for the citizens of Alaska. The majority approved a BSA increase while being disingenuous, paying the administration versus the classroom. Disingenuous in that ASD has $80 million in reserve. The past year, the Liberal increase is simply added to the cost of living in Alaska by approving a tariff to goods arriving at the port for a $1.1 billion bond. Now you're asking for more of my blood, and frankly, I'm about bled out. So again, no on HB 152. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I do not see anyone else online, so I will come into the room for public testimony. See no one in the room to testify. I will now close public testimony. Is there any additional discussion on House Bill 152? I had a question to the chair. And that was a question. I appreciate all the comments before about your willingness to look at amendments. Mm-hmm. I was wondering about a lot of workers who might be in the service industry and work several jobs. How do you plan to make sure that if this went forward, how they would not? I believe it's a certain date that the tax would be taken out of a worker's paycheck. How would you make sure that it wasn't taken out a couple of times from different work establishments?
Well, thank you, Chair Story. This is Elise Galvin for the record, and I will share that the Department of Revenue did come back with a note saying that their way to accomplish this, it was to have the worker who may have been deducted more than one time, the head tax, whatever that turns out to be, that they would then apply for a refund by showing their wage stub. We also think it would be a good idea to entertain an amendment that would allow the other employers to have an opportunity to give them either a form where they can, kind of like when folks fill out their W-4 form, you got the right number, they are allowed to, we all do this, we can put in an exempt, for example, if we don't want to have taxes taken out from the federal government, we can do the same sort of thing on the state side, or we also would entertain an amendment that would allow the worker to show a work stub from another employer if they have already had that head tax taken out. And really what we would be doing with that would be giving permission for in statute for the employer to accept that. And I'm going to also see if my staff would like to add more to that answer. Thank you for that question.
For the record, this is David Jang, staff to Representative Elise Galvin. It's kind of going off, so we would be amenable to potential amendments in one that could be on the rosters to exempt the head tax from the lowest earners. So, for example, in my model, if we exempted individuals that make $50,000 or below from that $150 head tax. Another thing I just want to mention for the record is that this 4% flat tax is only applied to individuals that make over $150,000 per year, and it's only on the dollar amount above $150,000. If you make just at $150,000, you would be taxed $0 from this 4% flat tax, and as it stands currently, it would just be the $150 head tax. Mm-hmm. I'll turn it back to the representative if she has further comment.
I really don't have any further comments on that question. I appreciate the question because the intricacy of putting some of these pieces in place, sometimes it's difficult to think through the implementation of the details of somebody, for example, working more than one job, if we know. So there's a kind of a nice working relationship and technical relationship between DOL, the Department of Labor Workforce, because they already do have all of the information, since employers have to put in information through them and they collect, and then Department of Revenue. So there is a lot already happening that is helpful. The other piece that's helpful is that Department of Revenue has the way this bill is written, there is an opportunity for an individual worker to place a check mark on their, either electronically or physically, on their PFD application, and then they can have that head tax removed from their PFD check. So that is another piece that is in place in this bill. There are further ideas that Representative Holland has brought forward to our office about this as well. So there's a lot of different tweaks that could happen in implementation that could be quite innovative and, I think, at the end of the day, helpful to Alaskans in other ways.
Thank you for those comments. Rep. Holland.
Great. Thank you. I think just a question and a comment for the moment, given where we're at, and I appreciate that we've had the testimony today and some additional work, and I'm continuing to want to learn and explore some more. The question I have first, through the chair, is just a clarification. It's my understanding that in the state of Alaska and under our Constitution, we can't distinguish residents from non-residents when it comes to this sort of taxation issue, that comes up as a, gosh, could we just have an income tax for the non-residents and leave the rest of us alone? But I don't think that we can do that. Could you clarify what you know about the whole issue of non-residents and different people, just to clarify, is that an option or not, or how can we think about that?
I appreciate that question, because it has come up over and over and over again. You know, a lot of folks here in Alaska feel it's unfair that so many workers who come up either for the slope or maybe for their big win in fishing, whatever it might be, and they come in and then they leave and haven't really paid into the infrastructure, whether they've driven our roads or used our healthcare facilities, et cetera. And the answer is no, we may not only tax some people and not others. There are some interesting things you can do with sales tax. You can have seasonal sales tax, for example. Some people feel like that way you could take advantage of when in the summertime when we have so many more visitors. Lately, some folks have had questions about that because we've spread out our tourism opportunities for revenue. And also, we've already gone through this, so I don't want to belabor it, but the issue with that is that we will be making it very difficult for rural areas and any area who already has a tax that's paying into their local government services. So that aside, the other piece, back to your question, the only way we can tax the income of workers who come in from outside, the only way is through a broad base. That means that every Alaskan has to get taxed at the same amount, or at least through the same rules. So there can be tweaks, like we've talked about, and have the lower income, for example, folks have a lower tax, et cetera. But we have to be fair and equal. But I guess it's important to note that if we do tax those who come up from out of state, then let's keep in mind that many of them pay more in their own state. They pay more income tax than what we are proposing. Income is anywhere between 8 and even up to 13%, even more in other states. So what we are doing is not a high burden here compared to other states, but they are not going to get double taxed. So if someone comes up and works on the slope, let's say in a project, and let's remember we're now at, we're going to have over 5,000 workers with Pica and Willow. So quite a few of those, I think we heard from my staff, that about 47% may be from out of state. Anyhow, those workers are able to pay tax here, and then they would write it in their adjusted gross income tax as a subtraction from their, before they pay their tax in their state, their home state. So they will not get double tax. That will be, that's really important. It's a federal law. Nobody's allowed to do it. So they would be protected from that double tax.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Great. Thank you. And just briefly, and this is more the comment, I appreciate the bill, the interest, and the opportunity to work with you. I'm particularly interested in how we can think about where IT systems have gone, automated wallets, because I'm concerned about the cost to the businesses, mm-hmm. you know, including the startups and the smaller businesses I work with having to administer this. And I'm concerned about the workers having to have another thing to, you know, take care of in that, in terms of, you know, annual returns and whatnot. And I'm also looking at the cost of, I think, 70 individuals that would be that are identified in the fiscal note. So there's a lot of administrative costs. And yet we're in a day and age where IT systems, AI systems, things are getting pretty smart. I mean, look at a company like Amazon that essentially said, you know what, we don't actually need a customer service department. They've created processes and systems so that you don't ever expect now to call, pick up a phone to call somebody to do a return, because they've designed a system so that it just is kind of baked into the processes. So I would invite us to, you know, look at how this is implemented with an eye towards how could it be done with some more advanced systems, because our current revenue systems, as I've learned through our budgeting process here, is pretty traditional in terms of just putting a bunch of people on doing forms and paper and scanning and whatnot. And I believe the fiscal note identifies imaging people in here. So I just would invite anybody who's interested in this issue to help us identify some best new practices on how we could look at this in a way that might minimize the burden to our business owners, to our employees, as well as to the state, and do something that actually take us a step further ahead in how we manage our money in a practical mm-hmm. way. So I think this bill provides us an opportunity to have a really valuable discussion in that area, and I look forward to working with people and invite others, particularly from my startup community and others, to think about, you know, new ways of doing this in a way that would actually be better, as opposed to just doing more of what we've did before. Thank you.
Thank you. And if I may add to that, I appreciate it through the chair. Representative Holland, this particular bill as it's written, and I'm looking for that slide, but I know that 75% of us will not have anything to do differently. Because of the systems that are currently in play, and I talked to you about Department of Revenue and Department of Labor already being connected. So in some ways, we have this sort of worked out based on what we're doing already. I'm sure there are ways that we can better utilize AI, not we, but the Department of Revenue perhaps, because it's revenue that they have to do certain things with as they bring in the money, and I don't know their scope of work and why 60, but it would be something that would be very interesting to look in a little bit further. Through the chair, I would also comment that we have a lot of ideas, and the you said the PFD form is really important here, because that also is saving us a lot of man hours, people hours, by the ability to check off that form instead of anyone having to send in a check, open up that check. All of that is resolved in that way. But as it's written, the bulk of the workers who would be participating would have really little to nothing to do. It's already going to be done online and done through, as you mentioned, your employees will still have to, the employer is already paying someone something, and as they set up their system, it would be part of that work in making sure that they have filled out that line as well for that piece of the head tax, the education tax. But anyhow, I think there's a lot that we could take advantage of, though? You had mentioned ways we can use a wallet and other things for other services. So maybe what we would be doing is taking this model and expanding it. I think that there's certainly opportunities for that. And again, this is an education head tax, but Chair Story, if there are amendments where people want to think about other ways of utilizing the mechanisms that will be needed to be in place, then we'd appreciate that discussion as well.
Thank you. And seeing no further discussions on House Bill 152, we are going to set this bill aside. And I would like to say that this concludes our business for today. Our next meeting is on Tuesday, May 6th at 3:15 in room 120. The current agenda for that meeting is as follows. House Bill 119, the Fairbanks Spur Line by Rep. Stapp. We will be rolling out a CS, which we will share with committee members as soon as we get it from legal. Then we will be having public testimony on House Bill 24, which we heard today, Aggravating Factors at Sentencing by Rep. Josephson. We will be hearing public testimony on House Bill 170, Kathleen's Law by Rep. Burke. And we will have introduction and public testimony on Senate Bill 40, Hispanic Heritage Month by Senator Gray Jackson. With no further business to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 5:13 p.m.